Now you know, in 1973, a white band that was funky really wasn't all that uncommon. I mean, there was Tower of Power, Cold Blood, Chicago, and even Blood, Sweat, and Tears. But a funky white band all the way from Scotland? Now that was rare and unusual. So when a friend of mine advised me to check out this group called the Average White Band, well, to be honest, I really didn't know what to expect. He let me borrow a copy of their first album called Show Your Hand, and I really couldn't wait to check it out. I played that album for 3 days straight, and I've been a huge fan ever since. Average White Band is not only a funky band, but they're also soulful, melodic, excellent musicians, and clever songwriters. Celebrating over 47 years, AWB is still working on and releasing new music and still touring. I was fortunate enough to catch up with founding member Ani McIntyre on their stop in New York, and he started off by explaining how the group was formed. My name is Dee Duane, and this is my one-on-one with the Average White Band.
Individually, in Scotland, we grew up in different parts of Scotland, as you said, but individually we all listened to soul music. Really, soul music was very popular in Scotland, and a lot of people think that's odd. But Scottish music is basically all about dance, as opposed to English music, which is a very different kind of dance. But the kind of music that we liked in Scotland was basically dance music. And the scale of bagpipes and Scottish dance music has a flattened 7 note in the scale, same as blues. So when we heard R&B, it just made total sense to us, apart from the fact that it was very exciting. You know, what became known as rock and roll really came from R&B. Soul music, in other words. So individually, we grew up in the 60s playing music individually in different parts of Scotland, listening to soul music. But obviously, the horn players listened to more jazz, like Cannonball Adderley, but they also listened to like Wayne Shorter, Miles Davis. But there was an underlying feeling of soul music underneath, like they loved Junior Walker, for example, who was a Motown artist at that time, very soulful,
right,
who played things in saxophone that nobody thought you could actually do because it wasn't in the rule book. Because he just learned, he wasn't taught to play, he just learned by himself, and he played all these amazing high notes. But it was also very soulful. So the combination of the different members all came together, actually, in London. Everyone had moved to London because the only place you could get a record deal in London in the early 70s, by this time we'd moved in the early 70s to London, was to be in London, because the only record companies were based there. There was no record companies outside of London. Even, you know, in the 60s, the Beatles and the Stones and everybody that moved from out of, you know, from anywhere north or anywhere, basically had to go to London to get a record deal. And the whole point was to get a record deal and get a record out. So
right,
individually, we'd moved there in the hope of getting a record deal. But some of us knew each other from Scotland. Alan Gorry, the original member and leader, is really, he was really the common denominator. He knew Molly Duncan and Roger Ball from art school in Dundee, which is on the east coast of Scotland, and also Robbie McIntosh, the original drummer. So they had actually played together, and they used to do shows and things, small gigs and jams and that kind of thing.
Right.
And the other member, I was from Glasgow, but I met Alan in London. He was living next door to me, and I was in a soul band, and his band were busy breaking up. So we spoke the same language, and he joined the band I was with, and we went off to Germany for 6 weeks and played all the U.S. bases. So playing in the U.S. bases, it was like playing in the United States, because all the cats were American, and but as soon as we played anything soulful, they said, oh, give us more of that, you know. So we went down very well with the black community and all the different military bases across Germany. So Aaron had the idea at the time, well, listen, if this is like playing in America, then there must be a market for the likes of us in the United States. Also, all the records we listened to all came from the States. We loved Motown, we loved especially Stax, anything from Memphis.
Right.
Was, you know, Al Green. The other thing was that in London, if there was an artist, for instance, Al Green came to London, and we were all there, we didn't tell each other, we just all turned up. And we would all say, hey, how you doing? And, you know, we're watching the show, and we say, well, let's go for a pint afterwards. So we go to the pub, and this happened two or three times, and then we said, well, why don't we just form a band with what we've got here? So it was basically six Scottish guys, and we decided to go back to what we'd started off playing, which was soul music individually. We all loved soul, but it wasn't in favour at the time. So it kind of went against the grain, you know. At the time, you had David Bowie had become popular, and it was more like theatre than music. You know, there was an emphasis on makeup and all that. We weren't that kind of band at all. We just wanted to play soul music that people could dance to. So we formed the band, and we got some backing, financial backing through our manager, and we started doing shows. Now, the shows in clubs in London at that time, people were still smoking a lot and, you know, sitting on the floor cross-legged and, you know, nodding to the music. But when we started playing, people would get up and start dancing. So the clubs loved us because people dance and then they get thirsty and so they go to the bar. So we sold a lot of drink.
Right.
Sold a lot of beer and, you know, pints of McEwen's and Heavy and all the different popular beers at the time. So we became popular, and also because people danced, they loved to come. So we basically made an impression, but we really wanted to come to the States. So we got a deal with MCA Records in London, and we recorded an album that was called Show Your Hand, which was the first album.
Yeah.
And it was released in England, but it was also released in the United States. So for the next album, we thought, well, let's go to America and we'll record there. So we flew over to LA and we knew some people there, and they put us up and we recorded an album, and then we took it to MCA Records. But they didn't really know who we were because we'd signed to the British, the European version of MCA Records.
Right.
And at that time, MCA was really a country label, so they didn't know what to make of the record. So we took it to Atlantic, and Jerry Wexler heard it and he loved it. So we basically left MCA and signed with Atlantic Records.
Yeah, and that's where you met Arif Mardin.
Well, Arif, Jerry Wexler recommended Arif to be a producer because he knew he was used to working with bands. You know, he had worked with the Young Rascals and he'd done all sorts of arrangements for Aretha Franklin and Donny Hathaway. You know, so he was really an arranger, and he was just the right man for us at the time, and uh-huh. a really lovely cat. I mean, a really soulful man, and you know, a pleasure to work with. And he basically let us do what we do, and then he cleaned it up. Basically, yeah. You know, he rearranged the songs, but he basically him and Gene Paul, son of Les Paul. The engineer basically just recorded. It was all about capturing the essence of the band on a take, like, you know, the excitement, and we imagined we were playing live. So there was an excitement that came across in the playing, but also the songs are pretty good. We had three really good writers, Alan Gorry, Hamish Stewart, and Roger Ball. And Roger had come from a jazz background, so he knew a lot more about theory, and he was able to put songs, you know, the format for songs together in a very musical way. And the soulful voices of Alan and Hamish Stewart really blended well. So it was basically two vocals, two horns, and two guitars.
Uh-huh.
So that was really the stamp, and we, you know, managed to come up with what came out naturally seemed to catch on, and I think the best example of that was Pick Up the Pieces.
Absolutely. In 1975, Pick Up the Pieces sold over 1 million copies. Now, how did that success affect the band?
Oh, that was a total change for us, because we, you know, we were starving in London, you know.
Thank you.
times when you're doing a show, you can't include everything.
Yeah.
And people are usually disappointed. Why you don't play Cloudy?
I know. And, that's one of my favorite songs. I love Cloudy.
Yeah, I know. And sometimes we can't put it in, because it's just a rough time. You can only do one or two ballads within a set.
Right.
And so we have two very good ballads. We have more, but we always play what's popular. You really have to play what's popular. People come to see the band, and it brings memories of when they were in college. We got a lot of people that were in college when we were successful in record-wise. And it brings back memories, and it's really a memory thing for a lot of people. And people have the favorites. They want to hear the favorites. They don't necessarily want to hear new stuff because they're not familiar with it.
Right. Right.
So you kind of, so you have to play to your audience, and that's basically what we do. What's so good about Seattle is that we play four or five nights and sometimes two shows a night. So we can include all the songs. If we don't play in the first show, we'll play in the second show.
Right.
And that keeps everybody happy, and it gives us a chance to try songs that, we haven't played for a while. So now it's good for the band in that respect as well. If you're doing concerts all the time and festivals, then you tend to, if you've only got an hour, or say 45 minutes or an hour, then you have to cut the set short and just put in what fits into that program, what's necessary for that show.
Cloudy, used to be so easy just to love you. Now, babe, you seem to have a million problems on your mind at the one time. Cloudy, don't you drift all you have to do.
1975, Cut the Cake was released, and with the passing of Robbie McIntosh, that was a difficult album to make, wasn't it? That white album, that was a tough one for the band.
Yeah, I mean, the ironical thing was that at the time we were trying to cut the Cut the Cake album, the white album took off.
Right.
So we were recording the Cut the Cake, and then their manager would come in and say, well, the record's number two with a bullet. You know, the album's number two with a bullet, and the single, Pick Up the Pieces, is number two with a bullet.
Right.
So, but meanwhile, you were trying to write material that was as good as that, you know. So in one hand, it was stimulating, you know. On the other hand, it was a little bit, you know, it was, well, how are we going to beat that, you know? But everybody knuckled round, and we got out the album and under difficult circumstances.
Yeah.
You know, well, Robbie wasn't involved, obviously, and his influence is very much still there.
I'm really glad that the band continued to stay together through all the tough times. After 47 years, what keeps the band moving forward?
You love to play. It's all about playing.
Uh-huh.
I speak to a lot of guys and bands that I've known, and if they're not playing, they really miss it. You know, there's something about playing to an audience and looking out and seeing an audience and enjoying themselves.
Yeah.
And I keep saying to people, you can't play to an empty room. You have to have an audience to play to. And it's really, everybody's in it together. You know, you're all in the room together, and we say, look, you paid your money to ourselves. You paid your, you know, why not give people what they want and have as good a time as possible? And then you forget all about politics, you forget about everything else, and it's escape. You know, you're in a club and you're having a good time, you're dancing, and we love to see people dance and just enjoy the music, and that's really what it's about. And it's a hard thing to give up, you know, I would think. Obviously, in the last few years, it's got more difficult with you know, now we spend hours at the airport because of security and all that stuff, and it's become harder. But, you know, Alan Gorry, our leader, basically is good at putting things together and working things out so that everyone has, you know, has as much comfort as possible. Where, you know, when we were like 20 years old, you'd jump in the back of the van and drive for hours, days, and you didn't care because everybody was having fun. But you get older, you start to, well, you know, I need a bed. You know, remember beds?
Right.
you know, it's one thing to curl up in the back of the van and sleep, but, you know, after a while, the novelty wears off.
And then in December of 1975, Average White Band appeared on Soul Train. What was that like?
Oh, we loved it.
Soul Train.
I got to tell you, man. We'd no idea that Soul Train had only been going nationally for about a year. We flew to L.A. in 1972 to do an album with Bonnie Bramlett. That was how we first came to the United States. And we immediately got into the room. As soon as we put our bags down, we put on television. And it happened to be, we'd flown overnight, and we got in a Saturday morning. And the first thing we saw was Soul Train. We go, oh, this is great, you know, with the break dancers and you know, and the doing the line of dancing and the,
right.
You know, and the quiz and Don Cornelius and all these people that were, we'd amazing dancers. And we'd never seen anything like that. So we were immediately hooked. I mean, from day one. And, you know, we used to say, oh, it'd be great to do Soul Train, but later on we actually did. And I think it was really good because we were able to play live. It wasn't lip-synced or anything, so you could just be who you were without having to worry about trying to sync up the vocals with the track and all that. You know, we just played live, and it really came across, and we loved doing it. I mean, what an experience.
Yeah.
Especially to see how the whole thing worked, you know, how people would come in and they had Kentucky Fried Chicken, they, you know, people, obviously Don Cornelius knew a thing or two about how to entertain a crowd and get them in and have a good time. So, you know, he'd all the food and everything and made it as comfortable as possible for everybody that was on the show. So people were lining up outside for hours before just to get on so they could dance and show their latest moves and... Oh, it was wonderful.
That's
absolutely wonderful. I mean, not to mention some of the other acts that were on. We saw Marvin Gaye a couple of times. Al Green was on live one time, and it's obviously one of the best things I've ever seen, ever. I mean, a live show with Al Green. I don't know what date it was, but he was on. He'd broken his wrist or something. He had a sling, like a scarf.
Right.
And he was singing and playing. And I've never heard, and I mean, I still go by and it gives me the shivers. I can watch that. You watch the drummer, and he's so intense. You know, he's watching Al in every move. He's right on the beat, and the band is out of this world. It's the most funky thing you've ever heard.
Right.
You know, and, oh, my God, it was, what a treat.
Wow.
What a treat.
Wow, I would have loved to have been there. I've seen that on Soul Train with Al Green with his arm in a sling. I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah, it goes da 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 da. Great horn line on it. You know, I can't remember the name of the song, but just the groove on it's just ridiculous.
Now you know your music has been heavily sampled by many hip hop artists. Is there a sampled song that you like the most?
Obviously we like. It's a great honor. First of all, it's a great honor to have your songs used for something else, and it's like a validation of what the music was in the first place, and just the idea that hip-hop artists would use certain tracks. The most sampled is Schoolboy Crush.
Wow.
By far. And I think it's something to do with the sleigh bells at the top of the song.
It is.
There's a guitar...
It's the sleigh bells.
You know, and there's a guitar line on there, and it just... It sets up the whole groove.
It does.
And that is the most sampled part of the song. And it's been used in so many songs, you know.
Yeah.
Which of today's artists do you like?
Oh, I love a lot of people, but Bruno, I think Bruno Mars is an exceptional performer and just one of the most musical guys you could imagine. I saw him, I didn't really know who he was, and I was watching television with my kid, and he was on, I think it was Sesame Street, and he was so natural and so talented and just so nice with the kids, but his playing ability, I mean, he plays guitar that you wouldn't believe. He can pick up anything and play, never mind his vocal performances. But, it's great to hear that. It's real talent. He's very musical. He plays instruments. It's not just about a beatbox.
Yeah.
And not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's just great to see someone as talented doing as well.
Absolutely. Any new projects for next year?
Yeah, we actually have an album out just now. It's called AWB Inside Out.
Uh-huh.
And it's called Inside Out because quite a few tracks were recorded in the studio, and if you want to say the inside tracks are recorded in the studio, the outside were live on shows. So you hear the live versions of songs we do, Let's Go Round the Gun, and they pick up the pieces, obviously, Soul Searching, Walk On By, Keeping It To Myself, Work To Do, the Isley Brothers song, which was on the White Album, are all live. So you get the impression of what the audience is listening to, and they can take it home and hopefully have fun with it.
Yeah, I like that Harvest for the World with that Chris Jasper on there. That's a really nice.
That was nice, wasn't it? Yeah, that was always been a favorite of ours. We loved the Isley Brothers. In fact, Work To Do was on the Brother, Brother, Brother album when we first came over to our first trip to the United States. And that we loved that version of What To Do, but we made it our own version, and it's it stood up pretty well. It's still a pretty standard song for on our set.
Well, I thank you so much for granting this interview today. Your music has meant a lot to me and to so many other people. Thank you again to the band for 47 years of some of the best music ever recorded, Ani. I really appreciate you guys.
Well, thank you very much. That's really good of you to say so. D. Wayne, it's been a pleasure.
Yes, sir, absolutely. And I'll
it's really a pleasure, and thank you for your support. Have the audience, whatever we're playing, come and hear us. Be prepared to dance. You're not going to get away without getting on your feet. So come down and we'll have a good time.
Sounds good.
I look forward to it.
Thank you so much, Ani. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, D. Wayne. Thank you, man.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Uh-huh.
Bye.
Average White Band has influenced many of today's hip-hop and R&B artists and has become one of the most sampled bands in music history. They have also inspired the godfather of soul, James Brown, who even put together an AWB tribute band. Average White Band is still currently on tour, so be sure to check your local listings and check them out live if you get the opportunity. I would like to thank Patrick Pateo and Lori Allred for their assistance and support of the Gubble Mix, and most of all, my sincere thanks to Ani McIntyre for taking the time and granting this interview. My name is Dee Dwayne, and thank you for listening to this one-on-one interview with the Average White Band right here on thegumblemix.com.